having first party data is really powerful in terms of like all the decisions that you make. But as you think about programming your own retail store, or as you think about walking into a conversation with a retailer like Nordstrom, you're walking into that conversation with a lot of information about how your customers typically behave. And you're able to use that to inform that conversation or that visual merchandising experience that you're designing for your customer.
Welcome to Behind the Numbers Brand Anatomy, an all-new eMarketer podcast that looks under the hood of your favorite brands, made possible by Tinuiti. It's November 24th, and I'm your host, eMarketer Briefing Director Jeremy Goldman, and this is the show that gets inside brands and dives deep into one of their recent campaigns. Today, we're talking with Brian Berger, founder and CEO of direct-to-consumer men's clothing company Mack Weldon. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah. Here's what we have on deck for you today. First, a speed intro where we get to know our guest in 100 seconds or less. Then, tell me something I don't know, where yours truly and this week's guest will bring a number, stat, or study that we find particularly fascinating and or relevant. And then we jump into this week's case study, how Mack Weldon is growing its brand through an omni-channel presence. All right, Brian, time for your speed intro, where we get to know you and see how quickly you think on your feet. 100 seconds on the clock. Our producer, Victoria, will be timing you. You ready?
I'm ready.
Your time starts now. Number one, where are you from?
I am from Long Island in New York.
What is your primary goal at Mack Weldon on a day-to-day basis?
My primary goal is to keep the team focused on our mission, which is building the next great menswear brand.
Love it. Favorite pizza topping?
Pepperoni.
Last person that you texted?
My wife. Actually, it was a family text about a new Mack Weldon product.
Nice. So I love that you're getting a lot of engagement close to home. who's one business leader that you especially admire?
Jamie Dimon.
Love that. You wake up and you learn that the earth is going to explode in 4 hours. What do you do with that time?
Wow. I grab my family. We jump in the car and we drive to a beautiful place outside the city.
What's something about you that nobody would ever guess?
I do Olympic triathlons.
Okay. Netflix, Hulu, or HBO Max? You can say Disney Plus if you want.
Ooh, that's a hard one. I'm going to go with HBO Max.
Okay, sounds good. That was pretty good. 13 seconds left. You win.
Thanks. Good job. I feel good. I won something today.
Now it's time for Tell Me Something I Don't Know. This is the segment where we each bring an interesting number, stat, study, or finding that most folks wouldn't know about, but will be highly relevant to brand marketers, and we explain why we think it matters. Here's what I'm bringing, Brian. I was taking a look at the U.S. digitally native brand D2C e-commerce sales over the next few years, and I've got some nice e-marketer numbers. I'm biased, but that's what I'm bringing. And it seems like that number is going to hit $38.26 billion in 2022 and $44.65 billion in 2023. So first off, I'm just kind of curious what your reflections are of that, you know, given that that's just the digitally native D2C brands and not, you know, all those other big players who are trying to get into the space.
I think it's an incredible stat. And I think it's a real validation of what makes a digital first, you know, direct to consumer brand special. And really, that is all about orientation around the customer and delivering a superior customer experience. It's not just about selling people stuff. It's about the experience they have and the way you're able to communicate with customers when you have that direct relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I featured this particular data in an article I wrote about what Quip's $100 million raise says about the future of D2C brands. And I think one of the things I didn't cover as much in that, but I'm curious what you think about, is whether or not these major, you know, brands that weren't digitally native, what they're learning from you guys and, you know, just essentially how the digitally native ones are kind of informing the conversation, if you will, about how to serve customers better online.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's advantages that incumbent brands have that, you know, emerging brands don't, but there's also deficits, right? They have a certain way of doing things. Their organizations are built to, you know, deliver around, you know, that way of going to market and that way of operating. So you have to sort of unwind some of that. But I think that if you take everybody's strengths and weaknesses and push them to the side, for an incumbent brand, I think one of the biggest takeaways they can have is that if they want to be successful, if they really want to build an experience that is unique and differentiated and different from what they had before, they really have to hire people and really build their organizations to operate and service the customer much in the same way a digital first brand does. And a lot of that just has to do with, for us, you know, it was existential, right? Like, we wouldn't have a business if we were not, you know, engineering our value proposition around, you know, the customer a certain way. And so for an incumbent brand that has a business and has seen success in the way that they have historically done things, for them to really be successful, I think they have to reorient themselves truly around thinking about the customer relationship as existential and really maximizing that.
No, I like the way that you put that. And I think also the difference, of course, with these digitally native brands is that they didn't have an investment in third-party retail. So they didn't have to worry about cannibalization. It's kind of like when you start being really focused on one particular thing and doing one particular thing well, you're going to really optimize as opposed to try to be all things to all people.
Absolutely. And having that control, especially in the early days, is really important. Like, you control the story, you control pricing, you control the entirety of the customer experience. That really sets a bar that consumers now expect from all of the brands that they shop with and that they consume. And so, you know, I think that even brands that have done a great job, there's a standard now that they're being held to, that I think a lot of that is driven by what, you know, ourselves and our peers have been able to do successfully.
Yeah, well said. Well, I don't want to focus on my data, you know, all the time. I'd love to spend a minute or two and talk about what you've brought to the table. So tell me, Brian, what do you have?
Mine is that, you know, over 90% of users have opted out of Facebook tracking them for advertising purposes with the release of iOS 14 and subsequent releases after that, and the gigantic impact that that has had. You know, obviously an enormous positive for consumers, but for marketers, it's presented a whole range of challenges that have made it really difficult to sort of think about, you know, how do we access, how do we get our messages in front of consumers in the way that we have historically without this particular, you know, channel being as available and as targetable as it has historically been.
So it's interesting because there's a lot of people I've spoken to around this, and I think there's some debate, but a lot of people think that, you know, you can still reach some of the same customers, but the measurement aspect of it is going to be off to some extent. So for you, is it more of a concern around targeting or more of a concern about being able to measure effectively how many people you've reached so that you can figure out how to optimize your spend?
Yeah, I mean, measurement is not really our issue because we have all first-party data and we have our own point of view on attribution. So we're not really overly relying on, you know, channels specifically to inform that. It is a reconciliation tool for us, but we don't live or die by that. It really gets at the targeting. I mean, you know, and nobody's really speaking truth on this, right? I mean, you speak to agencies that, you know, that work with brands like ours on paid social, and they act like nothing's changed. And it could not be farther from the truth. I mean, Facebook simply does not have access to, you know, even, you know, a fraction of the data that they had historically had access to. So it doesn't mean they have no data. They have lots of first party data, but all that stuff that they were getting from your browsing behavior and other more advanced things that they were doing with other, you know, other databases to kind of cross-reference, you know, information. I mean, all that is gone. And so everybody's acting like, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Like, everyone will just adapt. And it's just not the case.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely does seem from the people who I'm speaking to on the brand side that there's just a lot of uncertainty. And at the same time, there's a consensus that Facebook still is one of the best ways, almost by default, to reach your audience, just because, you know, where else are you going to throw all of that money, right? So
there's nothing that replicates its scale and the format. Right? Like, you know, Google controls more advertising and digital advertising impressions than anybody, you know, their banner ads though, you know, people don't engage with banner ads the same way. Obviously search is a completely different story, but you know, it's the format, it's the level of engagement, it's the audience, and it's the data. I mean, it's really, you know, that graph really matters. You know, you're not just getting information from the individual, you're getting the, you know, the power of the, and the multiplier effect of the data across relationships and connections and affinities and behaviors. And that's really where the power is. And so, you know, look, I'm the first one to say, like, let's figure out ways to give Facebook less money and make them behave. But as a marketer and as someone who thinks about how, you know, we're going to drive, you know, awareness and engagement with our brand, you know, it's a big, you know, lever that has been restricted in a way that we haven't seen before. So, you know, again, I think it'll force us all to be more creative, more nimble, less dependent, more diversified. I think ultimately it's a good thing, but in the near and medium term, it's, you know, it's a big deal.
No, absolutely. No, that was great. We're going to take a quick word from our sponsor, Tinuiti, and then we'll be right back.
When it comes to performance marketing, you need an agency that understands balance of brand and demand, art and science, of data and people, experience and innovation. You need a marketing agency that brings it all together without losing sight of what really matters, performance. Rethink performance with Tinuiti, the largest independent performance marketing firm across streaming TV and the triopoly of Google, Facebook and Amazon. Find out how at rethinkperformance.com.
Now it's time for our case study, where we look at a recent brand campaign or deployment and discuss what went right and some learnings for next time. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your more aggressive omni-channel approach and, you know, really kind of how you're trying to evolve your brand from something that was strictly D2C to something that is more omni-channel, that is available for more consumers in more ways.
Yeah, I think for us, it, you know, being, you know, solely direct consumer through our own e-commerce site was a very intentional strategy. We were very focused on controlling that narrative and making sure that we were establishing, you know, a direct relationship with our consumers. And in so many ways, that's benefited us just in terms of like how we've thought about product development, how we've thought about marketing and customer experience and merchandising. And I wouldn't change that for anything. But as we've grown and as we've diversified our value proposition, you know, again, in response to consumer demand, you know, it has become even more important to have other ways in which to tell our story, right? And so, you know, when you market the way that we have through channels like Facebook, we just spent a lot of time talking about Facebook, the message is inherently very narrow. So when you're selling a very limited range of products, that works. But if your goal and your objective is to, you know, in our case, capture a larger share of a guy's wardrobe, we just need additional ways to tell that story, right? And so when we opened up Hudson Yards in March of 2019, you know, that was really the first time we really fully understood, you know, the power of walking a consumer into a brand experience like what we've created there. And, you know, and that was really, you know, what underlied, you know, and what has informed a lot of the things that we're doing today.
Well, I'm wondering, it sounds to me like you're just trying to figure out how to be customer first in whatever ways possible. And obviously, there's some people who want to have that purely digital experience. And there are some people who want to touch and feel a product and see it, you know, firsthand in a store. I mean, what does being customer first, what does it mean to you? Because I think that used to be a buzzword and now people are really rethinking what that really means.
Well, it's multifaceted. I think there is a data component, right? And it's all the information that you're able to get and how you're able to feed that data back into the experience that you deliver. And then there is the actual experience that customers have with you. And that could be anything from making it really easy to buy products, try them on, return them if they don't work out. It could be having a really liberal return policy or exchange policy, just again, to get, you know, customers over that hump. It could be a loyalty program, like the loyalty program that we have, which really rewards customers who engage more deeply with us and try and foster a relationship that goes beyond just buying and, you know, selling. You know, it could be how you train your staff. It could be how it all ties together. So I do think it's a multifaceted thing, but in my view, it's really rooted in data on one side and the actual experiences that you're delivering through whatever touch point you have, whether it be physical or digital.
What does being e-commerce first as a business, which you were, you know, how does that help you sell wholesale? You know, like what are some of the things that you know about your customers, like which markets are most robust, which colors win? If you have any exclusive data that you want to share with our audience, obviously feel free, but, you know, curious what you know and how that helps inform, you know, going into wholesale and creating direct, you know, retail experiences.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, having first party data is really powerful in terms of like all the decisions that you make. But as you think about programming your own retail store, or as you think about walking into a conversation with a retailer like Nordstrom, you're walking into that conversation with a lot of information about how your customers typically behave. And you're able to use that to inform that conversation or that, you know, visual merchandising experience that you're designing for your customer. And so a specific example is like if we are, you know, having a conversation with, you know, an innerwear buyer at a place like Nordstrom that really only wants to be very narrowly focused, say, and buy one style from us, we can educate that buyer and say, well, actually, customers who buy this, X percentage of customers who buy this also buy this. So if you have these things cross-merchandised, it's likely that you're going to get a higher average order value from that customer. So that's one way. And the other way in the case of our own stores is, you know, we know how people shop. So we're able to, and we know, you know, what products are driving the most important loyalty for us. So we're able to feature those products in the best possible way in store.
Well, I know you were just kind of just talking about this as proving things with data. And I think one thing that's interesting everybody's kind of talking about now is LTV and how to maximize that lifetime value. And, you know, I'm wondering if you have a general sense or if you're able to share with us, you know, what's your LTV? What does it do to your LTV when you're able to sell somebody who's buying category X to convince them to buy category Y? And likewise, what's your LTV of an omni-channel customer? Does your lifetime value go up when you're able to turn somebody into an omni-channel shopper?
Yeah, so we know like, you know, which products or which first, you know, ordered products typically drive the highest, you know, lifetime value. You know, sometimes that's just rooted in, you know, when you're comparing underwear and sweatpants or chinos, it's not exactly apples to apples, right? Because one thing costs three times more than the other. And so you're starting out with a big advantage there. But, you know, as it relates to why the question of why is omnichannel important to us, we know that, you know, customers who shop in store and online, just on a 12-month LTV basis, are about 50% more valuable. Just in terms of the dollar revenue per customer. And as it relates to kind of cross category, and this is the thing that gets me most excited, you know, that number is like over 80%. So people who shop in-store and online cross category shop at a rate 80% above what a pure e-commerce customer does. And so again, it's not to say one is necessarily better than the other, right? Because, you know, the scale potential of online and the way we market there is enormous. But in terms of presenting a more diverse value proposition and merchandising story to consumers, you know, retail physical experiences have an ability to do that like no other channel. So it's great to see that in the data. It's great to be able to have that to inform the decision making that we need to do.
Absolutely. And I think that what's also interesting, something that has come up a lot in my conversations with retail and e-commerce executives, is the idea of supply chain. I feel like, you know, it's right before Black Friday, so we have to talk about it. How have you dealt with that? And how much of a challenge has that been for you guys, especially as an up-and-coming brand that might not have, like, let's say, the supply chain dominance that a Walmart does, where they can just, you know, buy a whole bunch of boats? I'm guessing that's not necessarily in your budget.
No, it's not. And it's, you know, look, it's affected everybody, if nothing else, just the hyper tracking of everything and trying to really understand what the impact is going to be has been disruptive in a sense. But I guess what I would say is for Mack Weldon, our products, you know, we go narrow and deep into categories. So this notion of just-in-time inventory doesn't really apply to us fundamentally because we always have reasonable depth of product. That said, you know, there are a lot of things that we were kind of banking on for Q4 that we knew could potentially be jeopardized by the situation with the supply chain. And so we had our plan and then we had multiple contingency plans to account for, you know, shipping delays. And we have, you know, had to, you know, take advantage of some of those in response to, you know, certain products not arriving in time.
So that's really interesting because I know that that is something that no marketer really wants to have, a backup plan to the particular thing that they're trying to spotlight. But, you know, it sounds like to some extent you've had to do that and had to try to figure out like this is our best case scenario. But if we don't have A, then maybe we're going with B.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes like anything, I think one of the things the pandemic has taught us is that how to get creative, how to be nimble, how to do more with less. And, you know, in the case of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, I would say any disruption that we've had has caused us to put forward, I think, what we all believe to be an actually a better, you know, value proposition for consumers, something that maybe we wouldn't have considered if we were not in this circumstance. Again, all under the umbrella of like, we were not ever facing a situation where we wouldn't have product to sell, right? This was more about like optimizing the right kind of marketing promotion. And so I think we ended up in a place that was better as a function of the fact that we had to really get creative.
Yeah, well said. In closing, Brian, this is great. I just want to ask you before you go, what are one or two brands that, you know, you as a consumer recommend and just happen to have a lot of respect for and you learn from or either just enjoy their products in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're big admirers of Lululemon and Patagonia for similar and different reasons, just in terms of consumer apparel. We really respect, you know, in the case of Patagonia, their ability to kind of weave, you know, storytelling and content into their and real authenticity around their mission into their, you know, overall value propositions. So it's never just about buying stuff. Lululemon, you know, is all about product, and we are a product first brand. So we really admire everything that they do at the product level and really appreciate that is why they've been able to be as successful as they are. So those are two, I think, that really come to mind. I'm a big runner, so I love Hoka running shoes, again, because the product is great and they have something that really fits every style of runner. So that's, you know, another brand that I'm a big fan of.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Some product recommendations, brand recommendations from somebody who's building a pretty strong brand in and of themselves. So, Brian, this was really fantastic.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Always love chatting.
Thank you so much for making the time. And that's all the time we have for today's episode. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you at podcast@emarketer.com. I'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode of the Behind the Numbers Brand Anatomy. We're off tomorrow for Thanksgiving, so have a great holiday. Make sure to tune in on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Tinuiti.